Tonight we are on page 34, is it? Approximately 31?
Yeah, 33.2.
I'm going to say 33.2 without knowing anything.
So this is the chapter more about alcoholism. If you have the regular big book, it's about three or four pages in. Right. And this is right after discussing the man of 30. There's four examples of different kinds of drinkers, different experiences that people had with their alcoholism. The man of 30 was an experience of somebody who recognized that his drinking was way out of control, but he was very, very ambitious. So he was able, using really serious willpower, he was able to put alcohol aside for a number of years until he retired. What happened is he did have alcoholism, and alcoholism is progressive. Over any considerable period of time, it gets worse and never gets better, whether you're drinking or not. So what happened was when he picked up alcohol after 25 years of abstinence, he was dead in 4 years. He drank himself to death within 4 years after making a ton of money. And listen, he tried to get sober. He was going back to Happy Hills time and time again, and he just could not pull it off. Alcoholism is progressive. It's progressive. And when we've been sober for a considerable period of time, when we go back to it, the chances of you getting and staying sober after that are less than average. Many old-timers, we're finding through some of the treatment centers that many old-timers are showing up because they've relapsed because of pain medication. You know, listen, we all have accidents, we all have surgeries. But what's happening is people with 20, 30, 40 years in AA are showing back up in the detoxes and the treatment centers because of these, you know, getting hooked up with the oxys. And it's incredibly difficult for them to reconnect and be able to stay sober after that type of an experience. So it says here, young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Time and time again in this book, it talks about the mental obsession. The great insanity, the second step insanity that they talk about in this book is when we believe we're in charge of our own relapse. When we believe we can prevent our own relapse by just not wanting to relapse. That's the insanity that they talk about in the second step. Time and time again, they explain in here that if you really are alcoholic, the time and the place will come where you won't have a mental defense against relapsing. That's why we have to do all this stuff. That's why we have to do the meetings, the steps, the service, because we have to place ourselves in the atmosphere where the power greater than ourselves can relieve us of the obsession to drink. That's the only thing that any of these guys ever found that would work. These were all hopeless alcoholics back in the day. They were all people who doctors said, you know, don't come back in. It's just too heartbreaking to watch you. You know, you're either going to need to be locked up or you're going to die. Several of our crowd, men of 35 or less, had been drinking but a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. Another thing to point out that's worth pointing out in this book is time doesn't matter. Amount doesn't matter. Consequences don't matter. That's not the barometer of alcoholism. Okay? The barometer of alcoholism is a barometer of power, choice, and control. There are people who've had 12 DUIs who are really not alcoholic. They're just horses' asses. And then there's people who've never had a DUI who are unbelievably alcoholic. You know, and it has less to do with consequences, time, or amount than we would think. Now, why do we get this idea that it has to do with consequences? Because when we go into treatment centers, they give us questions. You know, has your alcohol ever done this? Have you ever gotten in trouble? Has it affected this? Has it affected that? You know, they're trying to convince you that your drinking is a problem. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to offer you the material you need to decide whether you're alcoholic or not. Not whether you're a problem drinker, whether you're alcoholic or not. Because if you're alcoholic, That's progressive, it's fatal, and you will die unless you find a power greater than yourself. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantities some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential feminine alcoholics often turn into the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholic are astonished at their inability to stop. That really is our problem. You know, the inability to stay stopped is really what our problem is. How many in here have had brief periods of sobriety and then ended up, you know, on one more tear? I mean, that's so indicative of alcoholism. We who are familiar with the symptoms see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try and get them to see it. As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our willpower. Very important sentence. If you're an alcoholic, alcohol means so much to you that by the time it has turned on you enough to, for you to want to separate from it, you will not be able to. That's why before AA and before the Washingtonians and before the Oxford Group, 99 alcoholics out of 100 died. They drank themselves to death. Every once in a while, there would be a religious conversion experience that would pull somebody out of that alcoholism. But that was what Carl Jung was talking about as a phenomenon. It's not something that you could predict. It's not something that you could plan. It was a phenomenon. But for the most part, alcoholics were doomed since man started crushing grapes. And what happens is by the time we really want to stop drinking, we can't. One thing I heard, you know, I'm not much for one-liners, but every once in a while there's one I like. And this one is, the chains of alcoholism are too soft to feel until they're too strong to break. And I understand what that means, because when I finally said, okay, alcohol has to go, it had to be serious, you know what I mean? I mean, listen, I had lost families and jobs, and I walked 10 years with DUIs and crashed cars and puked out the window and, you know, 100 injuries that I wouldn't even go to the emergency room for. You know, I'd tape them up with duct tape. I mean, the stuff that I would put up with was unbelievable, you know. And finally, you know, it got to the point where I really thought I was losing my mind and I thought I was going to kill my family. Because the last incident that happened during my last drunk, I threatened my family with a handgun. And It easily could have been. I could have pulled the trigger. That could have easily happened because they said something. You know what I mean? What did you say? You know. I mean, we're insane. We're insane when we're in these blackout drunks. So the thing that really pushed me over the edge was when I drank. I lost control. I was a Jekyll and Hyde drinker, and I came out of this last blackout finding out that I had threatened the lives of my family, and that really got my attention. Like, I didn't mind if I would die. You know, listen, that was, who cares if I'm going to die? You know, that would be a sweet release. But to end up in prison for 30 years because you've killed your family, I could not face that. So I went about the business of not drinking. And my previous attempts before that always ended in failure. Always ended in failure. This last time, because I wrapped myself so tight around Alcoholics Anonymous, I made every waking moment I wasn't working about AA, I was able to make it long enough to stay sober long enough to find a recovery process. You know, and I'm incredibly grateful for that. And without that recovery process, the time and the place would have come where I would have taken my own life, I would have just flipped the switch and gone crazy, or I would have drank again. Because I had a really bad case of alcoholism. As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years behind the point we could quit our willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. Now, this sounds like, oh my God, they're telling you to drink. And this is not something that you want to use as a topic for a discussion meeting down the street. But this is how they thought back then. And Marty Mann was the first female alcoholic to stay sober, and she started the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence with Bill and Bob. She was an important early member of AA and a very important person in drug and alcohol treatment. She had a test. The Marty Mann test was this. All right, if you're not sure you're an alcoholic and you're not going to buy into our 12 steps and our fellowship, you don't want to do the whole deal, you know, you're not really sure. Okay, if you're not really sure, here's what we want you to do. And this is what she would tell you to do. Take two stiff drinks, you know, two shots or two beers a day for 60 days. You can't save them up. Okay? Now, if you can get 60 days of drinking two drinks, because the two drinks start the engine, you know what I mean? If you can do that, and without a lot of problems, you're probably not alcoholic. However, if you're alcoholic, what will happen is on the third day you'll decide that you've already passed the test, so there's no real reason for going 60 days. You know? So if there's any reason at all that you don't go 60 days, they would consider you an alcoholic. Now, I don't use this very often. I think it's much better to dig into somebody's past experience and show them from their own experience that they're alcoholic. But every once in a while, you'll get somebody who may or may not be an alcoholic. And I think there's been two times in the last 23 years where I've suggested this out of the book. Okay, you really don't think you're an alcoholic. Okay, you're a crack behemoth, but you know, no alcohol history at all. Okay, well, try this. Take two drinks. This says basically for 30 days, and the reason they're allowing you to risk the relapse is knowledge of whether or not you're a real alcoholic is going to be so valuable to you that once you're totally convinced that you're an alcoholic, that's the first step. And they believe that it's necessary to be able to accept the first step, to fully concede the first step, to be able to move through the rest of this program. If you're not convinced you're an alcoholic, they know you're not going to go pay the money back. You're not going to go knock on Mrs. McGillicuddy's, you know, door and make amends for stealing her lawnmower or, you know, whatever. They know you're not going to do that. They know you're not going to develop a discipline of prayer and meditation. So it's more important to find out the truth than it is if you have another hangover. How many hangovers have we had? Try leaving liquor alone for a year. If he's a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there is scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolution, most of them within a few weeks. That was me. Seriously, this is what my life looked like. I would come to in the morning and I would swear to God that today is the day I'm going to give this up. I can't believe how terrible I feel. I've got to go to work. But, you know, I'm poisoned from alcohol and I've got to go to work. I'm just shattered. And I'm saying, you know, why did I do this? Tonight is the night that I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And, you know, the whole morning I would go through the whole morning absolutely convinced I'm not going to drink. But by quitting time, I'd already made a decision to stop at the liquor store on the way home. You know, that's the insane cycle. Excuse me. That's the insane cycle of alcoholism. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. This is a very important sentence. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends somewhat upon the strength of his character and how much he really wants to be done with it. But even more will it depend upon the extent which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. This is completely different than the Big Book, and this was heavily edited. In the Big Book, it basically says the ability of someone to quit drinking on a non-spiritual basis will depend upon how much control one has lost in drink. So that's part of the barometer I was talking about earlier. You know, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, you know, I believe that there is a scale, and the scale or barometer is all about how much power of choice we've lost in drink. There is nothing more heartbreaking than seeing a family member who's, you know, burnt one more house down or crashed one more car or lost one more family. And you see them walking home from the liquor store with, you know, a 12-pack under their arm. And you're like, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? Well, you know, what's wrong with them is they've lost the power of choice in drink. And when you confront them about it, why do you have Budweiser? For God's sake, you're going to prison, you know, for your fifth DUI. They're going to look at you like this. Because it doesn't compute. There's no real answer for why am I doing it, except get out of my way, stay out of my business. It's none of your business. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. Leave me alone. I mean, that's the only thing we can do is throw up a defense like that. Many of us felt we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. This utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or wish. I'm going to tell one story and then I'm going to pass it over to Dave. There was this guy that we would do 12-step calls on all the time. He was in our local area. And he was a chronic, critical, late-stage alcoholic. And we would get a call from his wife, and it would be, you know, ER time. I mean, this guy survived 3 esophageal varices incidents, okay? Usually you don't survive the second one. It's incredibly rare to have and survive a third one. But what that is your liver has broken down in its ability to deal with alcohol to such a point that the veins in your throat rupture and you bleed out choking to death on your own blood. Now, this would get one's attention, wouldn't it, Dave?
Not all cases.
Okay? I mean, listen, this is not something you want to go through. They literally have to cauterize your throat with a cattle prod to stop the bleeding, okay? This is something that's going to get your attention. This guy went through 3 of them. And every single time we went into the hospital, into the emergency room, to do a 12-step call on him. And, you know, I would say stuff to him like, you understand you're alcoholic. You know, he's got all the tubes and everything. You understand that you don't have the power of choice with alcohol, and alcohol's going to kill you. Yeah. You understand that your life is none of your business anymore if you're an alcoholic. You know, you need to set your life up as a life of recovery, of meetings, of steps, of service. Your life is not any of your business. You can't just do what you want to do anymore. You realize that, right? Well, yeah. And so he would get out of the hospital, and we'd go over to his house to take him to a meeting. And he would do this. He would go, oh, wow. Like, you know, it's been really tough, this hospital thing, you know. And my buddy up in Maine has a yacht. And he wants me to spend a week with him, like sailing around the Maine islands. I really need a vacation after all this hospital stuff. And we would look at him like, you're insane. You're crazy. You know, don't you realize how much trouble you're in? And it wouldn't penetrate. And of course he'd go up to Maine and he'd start drinking and end up in the hospital, you know, on some guy's schooner. I mean, it just, you look at this and you think, I cannot believe that this person has the ability to go through this much punishment. But what it is it's that utter inability to stay separated from alcohol on a non-spiritual basis. he's not doing the spiritual work, he's not going to stay separated from alcohol. It's simpler than it looked. You know what I mean?
So that's a bad idea, though?
You know, the rehab, the vacation, the post-rehab vacation, yes. It's always necessary.
Always necessary. Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Hey. So we're going to cover briefly, and then we're going to stop a little early today so we can have cake, but we're going to cover briefly. Bill wants us to have a complete and thorough understanding of what he sees as the strange states of our mind that precede a new drinking bout. You know, he's going to introduce us to Jim. Jim, who has a very subtle and pernicious kind of resentment. And I can understand those. Anybody here ever have a subtle and pernicious kind of resentment? Something that you hung on to and thought was a character plus, not a character defect? You know, I have a right to be angry at those people. I have a right to be mad at those people. They're wrong no matter how you look at it. But what ends up happening for me is that many times before I would drink again, I would run out of excuses to stay sober. The delusion would very cautiously toss me reasons why this not drinking thing was a bad idea. It would cautiously toss me little breadcrumbs along the path and say, "Why don't you come over here? It'll be fine over here. Don't worry about it. Don't, you know, that stuff that you heard those people say, that doesn't really mean anything." And I'd always have it, you know, one of those interesting things that I heard in a meeting that would go through my mind, you know, and I'd say, no, I can't do that. The funny thing is, after a while saying I can't do that, I begin to believe that I can do that. And I start to have this kind of realistic approach to shooting down the little bit of defenses that I think I have, because my mental ability to defend against the delusion is very limited. And the delusion will allow me to think that I'm winning as it's kind of luring me into the channel where it'll cut me off and choke me. And it comes at me in a lot of ways. You know, most of the time, the way it comes at me is it'll start out with, "You guys are wrong in some manner. Something that they did is wrong. Something that happened to me justifiably is wrong. And something has just kind of gone wrong. The boss isn't treating me right. She isn't treating me right. Or they aren't treating me right." It's usually how it starts for me. And it's kind of how it started for Jim. Let's go to the chapter. Okay, so how then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? Now, I'm going to tell you this. I wasn't really thinking. I was done thinking. I was acting, and I was reacting to the pain of my life and the pain that you guys had caused me. I'm going to go take care of that the only way I know how. Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable war record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew of alcoholism and the answer we had found. He made a beginning. His family was reassembled and began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Now, this is incredibly important to me. How often, who's been to more than one AA meeting in this room, right? Who's been here for a few years and wandered into other meetings over the years? Who's seen the guy who seemingly appeared to have it all, or the gal who seemingly appeared to have it all together, only to find out that they drank later on, right? What is the cause of that? Is it because they unlearned the knowledge of what was going on? Did they somehow get struck drunk? What inevitably happens, and I see this all the time, and it's something that I did. I wanted to do a certain amount of work and stop there. Because anything that happened beyond the certain amount of work was inconvenient. Oh, take the new guy to a diner tonight? Isn't the new Dexter on? You know? Really? Seriously? So what would end up happening is, how many times have you seen this happen? Yeah, the guy's a first three-step wonder. He's really on fire. He really wants to do this. He's doing 4, 5, 6, and 7. He's rock and roll. He's starting to drag a little bit at 8. Anybody here personally drag at 8? Anybody here drag at 9? Anybody here think that after 9 it was going to be okay? You had no more work to do? Right? What happened to me when I failed to enlarge my spiritual condition was I lost the one thing that had a guaranteed success rate of keeping me sober. Right? Thinking and knowledge and experience in doing inventory doesn't keep me sober. Having a spiritual awakening is what keeps me sober. It's not something that I can accomplish on my own. It just happens because I'm available, because I'm no longer pushing myself aside. So here we're going to talk about Jim, who seemed to have failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And this is where the subtlety of the entire process comes to me. What happens for me is that I don't notice that I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. It suddenly seems that if I look back, I just haven't been as busy as I've been recently. You know, I've been busy in my personal life. I've been busy in work life. And all of a sudden, I just don't have time for all that AA stuff. I don't have time for working with the new guy. I don't have time for the inventory of 10 and 11. You know, I got busy. I was on a boat in Costa Rica, and I found out when I was way out into the ocean, of course, that the captain was an alcoholic, which usually would worry me, except he was a recovered alcoholic. And we started to talk when we were out in the middle of this ocean, catching no fish, by the way. I had a resentment. And he said to me, "You know, Dave, if you're too busy for AA, you're too busy." And I said, "You know what? You're right. You're 100% right." But that's what ends up happening. The first thing that goes for me is that spiritual experience and that spiritual awakening, because I'm too busy with material things. He failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, revealing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had deep affection. Yet he got drunk again. Now, he has a lot of knowledge. He's working with the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whatever knowledge they had, they were giving it to him. We asked him to tell us exactly how it had happened. This is his story. "I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated." That's a key word for resentment. "I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I had once owned." So obviously he had lost it. "I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I've been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. And here we go. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach." Who in the world here ever put an ounce of whiskey in your milk? Anyone? Bueller? Anyone? No one. Right? What kind of crazy thinking is that? I mean, when I was 16, I'd drink milk before going out under the delusion that it would help me stay sober longer as I overdrank, right? But it never really solved the problem, it seemed. I don't know where he gets this stuff from. Anyway, "I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey in a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. And here we go. Isn't this the thing that has always sunk me, is that it begins this way? Something so innocuous and something so easy. This started on one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. Yet all reason for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise mental definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? I once heard a man say on a workshop that I was listening to that the most insane thing that you'll ever do is to drink sober. And I thought that odd, right? Because I know coming in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew when I rolled through the door that there was something wrong. I knew that the wheels had come off, and I knew that it wasn't working anymore. And I wasn't sure whether I was insane or not. I had that kind of crazy thought in my mind that if you're insane, you don't know it. So just the fact that I was asking myself the question might mean that I wasn't insane. But I heard him say this on the tape, that the most insane thing that he would ever do is drink again while sober. And I suddenly understood exactly what he was talking about. The clarity is that I wanted to have the knowledge. Over the years, I wanted to have the knowledge. I wanted to have the God of reason. And I wanted to have all the things that made me smarter than you, because I was preparing for a reason to leave here. Because I was going to go drink again. Right? The insanity is that I will do whatever it takes to end up back at a drink, even though where I came from, I was a low bottom drunk. I did not come into these rooms easily. I didn't come in here because I wanted to. I was committed into an insane asylum at 23. I was a low bottom drunk. And somehow, some time passes, I get cleaned up, I start shaving, I start showering, I start brushing my teeth, you know, I start eating three meals a day, and that stuff starts to fade from my thinking. And I'm left with the insanity of myself. I no longer have the alcohol to blame. I no longer have the drugs to blame. I no longer have them to blame. And I'm left with me. And the most insane thing I'm going to do is return to a place that has never worked. Return to the place where I wanted to put a gun in my mouth and end my life. To return to a place where there was no hope and that everything was wrong. And yet here we have Jim, right? Lost his business, but his family had been reassembled. Things are starting to come together. And he's sitting in a diner somewhere. And suddenly the thought crosses his mind. This would be a great idea. Right? How insane are we? We come up with the most insane and trivial excuses to drink. And I burn through the lives of my family members. I burn through the lives of the employers who love me and want me just to do well at their job. I burn through the lives of everybody around me because they've trusted me one more time. And the wheels have come off again because in my mind, something is not okay. Something is separated. You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of our group. Some of us have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there are always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnestness and sincerity, how could it have happened? And I would always ask that question because I didn't know how it happened. It just seemed to happen. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we began to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was a little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. There was a study done about people that smoked cigarettes. And they took this large body of people that smoked cigarettes. And they asked, and they followed them, and they watched how they smoked, and they said, you know, do you know that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer? Right? And the answer was, they all knew that smoking cigarettes caused lung cancer. And then they asked them, do you understand that the percentage of the population that gets lung cancer from smoking cigarettes is this number, whatever that number was? And they all said, yes, we understand that. And they gave them a body of knowledge. And nobody quit. Nobody stopped smoking cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And they gave them more information, and they followed these people, and they kept smoking. And they wondered why these people smoked. And they wanted to know why. And at the end of the day, their analysis was that while, if I told you, taking a gun and putting a bullet in one of the six chambers, spinning the cylinder and putting it to your head, would eventually result in your death, the probability of that is very high. Might happen in the first trigger pull, might take 12, right? But if you keep doing it, you're going to end up dead. The probability of you not is very, very small. The person who smoked cigarettes they defined as the person who believed it would not happen to them. They couldn't refute the knowledge. They couldn't get away from the truth. So they had to make the truth not applicable. And that is that strange mental blank spot for me. Somehow this time it's going to be different. Somehow this time it's going to be okay. Or somehow the rules aren't going to apply to me. And I think I'm going to wrap it up there unless you want to do something. That's good. You good? All right, so we're done. Okay.